United States versus Brock. Mr. Hudson?
May it please the Court, my name is Zach Hudson, and I represent the defendant appellant in this case, Michael L. Brock. Mr. Brock's prior convictions for merely possessing restricted weapons should not count as violent felonies under the Armed Career Criminal Act, or ACCA. Once certain requirements are met, there are essentially three ways for a violent felony to qualify, for a prior felony conviction to count as a violent felony under ACCA. First, that felony can be one that involves the use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force against another. Second, it can be one of the enumerated felonies, burglary, arson, extortion, or use of explosives. And third, as most relevant here, that prior conviction must be a felony that involves the serious potential risk of physical injury to another. Mr. Brock's prior possessory convictions have none of these attributes and thus should not count as violent felonies under ACCA. In Upton, this court held that a different sort of restricted weapon, a sawed-off shotgun, qualified as a violent felony under ACCA. But that decision can no longer stand under more recent decisions of the United States Supreme Court and this court. In Begay v. United States, the Supreme Court held that in order for a prior conviction to count as a violent felony, that conviction must be similar both in kind and degree of risk posed in order to count as a violent felony. In other words, that crime must present a risk that is similar in degree to the crimes enumerated in ACCA, namely burglary, arson, extortion, and use of explosives, and it must be purposeful, violent, and aggressive. Now, Mr. Brock's prior convictions are not purposeful, or not violent and aggressive, as the other crimes listed in ACCA are: burglary, arson, extortion, and use of explosives. The majority of courts of appeals to have addressed this issue since Begay agree with Mr. Brock that mere possession of restricted weapons should not count as a violent felony under ACCA. The Fourth Circuit in Haste so held that, and that was on a remand from Begay, from the Supreme Court, that mere possession of a restricted weapon is not a violent felony under ACCA. The Sixth Circuit reaffirmed, essentially, its pre-Begay precedent, Amos, in a guidelines decision, Hawkins, holding that mere possession of a restricted weapon is not a violent felony under ACCA. And the Eleventh Circuit in McGill also held that mere possession of a restricted weapon is not a violent felony under ACCA. The lone circuit to go the other way post-Begay is the Eighth Circuit in a decision called Vincent. And that decision is, by and large, unpersuasive. Vincent primarily relied on a decision of the Tenth Circuit holding that possession of weapons in prison was a violent felony. And the prison context makes this case wholly different from Mr. Brock's case. Begay's test and the Fourth Circuit and Eleventh Circuit's application of that test is well-grounded in the text of ACCA's statute. The statute is all about active crimes. It talks about the use, threatened use, and actual use of physical force. It speaks of burglary, arson, extortion, use of explosives. All of these things require action, volitional action by the criminal, whereas mere possessory crimes are, by comparison, much more passive and different in kind from the crimes listed in ACCA. Indeed, possession of a restricted machine gun, like that at issue here, is in many ways a regulatory offense. You can own machine guns in the United States in the vast majority of states if certain requirements are met. Most notably, you have to obtain the permission of certain law enforcement officials, obtain a license, and pay a tax. But as we pointed out in our brief,
is that true of machine guns manufactured after 1986?
Civilians cannot own machine guns manufactured after 1986, Your Honor. But machine guns manufactured before 1986, if you fill out the appropriate ATF forms, obtain permission from the local law enforcement chief, pay a one-time $200 registration fee, and have a license, then in the vast majority of states, a civilian can own a machine gun. Now, it is true that in some states it is categorically banned, Indiana is not one of them. And in some states, you have to be a Class 3 firearms dealer in order to possess a machine gun, even if it was a machine gun manufactured before 1986. But in the vast majority of states, civilians can own machine guns that were manufactured before 1986. So it's still, in many ways, a regulatory offense. It's not the case that if you started planning your arson or burglary before 1986 that you can engage in arson or burglary. So I think there is a meaningful difference in terms of how the crimes themselves are treated.
But don't you think it's meaningful that Congress, in the Hughes Amendment, enacted a prospective ban on machine guns, indicating a sense or a judgment that these things just ought not to be permitted? And of course, there was the earlier guns, the pre-existing guns were grandfathered, but perhaps that just reflected a judgment that Congress didn't want to create 50,000 or 75,000 or 100,000 felons with the enactment of a law just because they happen to have a machine gun stored in their gun rack or in their garage.
Your Honor, I think that's probably exactly what the motivation of Congress was, to grandfather in these prior guns. And I think that, as you point out, Congress certainly recognized in banning machine guns that were manufactured after 1986 from being in the hands of the vast majority of civilians that there is something dangerous about machine guns. But two relevant points. First, they didn't ban all machine guns, and I think that it would be a different case if they had, because, as I've already said, you can still own machine guns under certain circumstances. And second, the fact that machine guns are dangerous, though relevant, or can be dangerous, though relevant, is really not the question, in my view. The question is whether or not it's possessing machine guns, the offense of conviction here, is dangerous in the same manner and to the same degree as the enumerated felonies in ACCA, namely burglary, arson, extortion, and use of explosives. And I think that use of explosives really points out why merely possessing machine guns isn't as dangerous in terms of both manner and degree as the enumerated felonies, because if ACCA said possession of explosives, it would be a much tougher case for us. But it doesn't. It says use of explosives. And the other crimes, arson, burglary, and extortion, are also much more active than merely possessing a machine gun. So though Congress certainly feels that machine guns are violent in some way, there is no indication that the Hughes Amendment or the other statutes which you referenced speak to the fact that possessing machine guns is dangerous in the same way as burglary, arson, extortion, and use of explosives. And that's the relevant question under prevailing Supreme Court case law.
Mr. Hudson, let me ask you about the rationale behind Upton and the relationship between ACCA and the sentencing guidelines. If I look only at the text of ACCA, your point, particularly with the specific reference to use of explosives, sounds pretty persuasive. But if we agree with you, we basically drive a significant wedge between the violent felony and crime of violence. Have I got the right phrase?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, okay, violent felony and crime of violence in the two bodies of law, at least as applied to these crimes of unlawful possession of restricted weapons. I'm troubled by that, and look for comfort.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I think there are a couple of important differences between the guidelines and ACCA, and this Court recently noted them in Ruff, which I brought to the Court's attention in the 28J letter. But I think, really, there are three important things to note with respect to the guidelines in ACCA. First, Congress enacted the statutory text of ACCA. Congress did not write the guidelines. The Sentencing Commission wrote the guidelines. And when the Sentencing Commission includes a laundry list in the application notes following the guidelines, that list is not subjected to the same sort of scrutiny as whether or not something counts as a violent felony under ACCA. So it's possible, though admittedly awkward in some circumstances, to treat the phrase violent felony under ACCA differently from the phrase crime of violence in the guidelines. Second, this Court would not be the first Court to treat the two differently. The Fourth and Sixth Circuits have treated what counts as a violent felony for possessory crimes under ACCA and the guidelines differently. So the Court wouldn't be embarking on an entirely new path. Third, with respect to how criminals are treated under ACCA's violent felony provisions and the guidelines' crime of violence provisions, the consequences are quite different. if a violent felony under ACCA results in a mandatory minimum of 15 years in prison, whereas treating something as a crime of violence just results in the issuing of another guideline which the judge can depart from. And now, admittedly, they have to have reasons to depart from it, but under the two situations that had the exact same crimes, the penalty will often be 50% greater when it's treated as a violent felony as opposed to a crime of violence. So there are good reasons for treating the two differently, in my view, Your Honor. Additionally, it seems that the government's main argument is that the Sykes opinion somehow changed the analysis after Begay. And in my view, that's not the best way to read the cases. If you look at what Sykes actually did, it pretty much applied Begay, irrespective of what it says. The first thing that Sykes did was look to see whether or not criminal flight was similar in kind to the enumerated felonies in ACCA, most notably there, burglary and arson. And the Sykes majority concluded that burglary often ends in confrontation, so does criminal flight. Arson is the unleashing of a destructive force onto others, and that's the same thing with criminal flight. And that's really just Begay's similar in kind inquiry. Then the court moved on to do a quantitative comparison, and it said that flight resulted in 4 injuries for every 100 flights. Burglary resulted in 3.3 injuries for every 100 burglaries. And arson resulted in 3.2 injuries for every 100 arsons. So really what Sykes did was just step through the Begay analysis. I think it's important to point out that, though not dispositive, it provides useful information for the court, that the author of Sykes, Justice Kennedy, was in the Begay majority, and the author of Begay, Justice Breyer, was in the Sykes majority. So, and Justice Kagan, in her dissent in Sykes, pointed out that the majority was retaining Begay and just simply found it redundant in that case. Now, as the government points out, there is some problematic language in Sykes, but that language is best read as a rejection of Mr. Sykes, Marcus Sykes, the petitioner's construction of Begay, and not a critique of Begay itself. Mr. Sykes had argued that his particular prior felony conviction was not a violent felony under the purposeful, violent, and aggressive test, and the court concluded that after conducting a similar in kind and similar in degree test, that Mr. Sykes was wrong. That doesn't mean that Begay is dead letter. It just means that in that particular case, the purposeful, violent, and aggressive inquiry was not useful.
Mr. Hudson, can I ask you about the other issue in this case having to do with the spousal privilege?
Yes, Your Honor.
Particularly the testimonial privilege, mm-hmm. As it came up. The government suggested argued in their response brief that Mr. Brock doesn't have standing to assert that right. I didn't see a response from you in your reply brief.
Your Honor, it is true that based upon the case law cited by the government and cases dealing with calling one's spouse at a trial, that Mr. Brock would not have standing to complain that his wife testified against him. But in my view, that kind of misses the point of Mr. Brock's argument here. His argument is that there can never be a waiver of any marital privilege based upon the pre-indictment testimony of a spouse, and that can be raised by either person. Now, admittedly,
That's a pretty broad argument.
It is a broad argument, Your Honor.
Particularly where that spouse chooses to testify even after being advised by the judge or the prosecutor or defense counsel or independent counsel about her rights. Let me ask you a slightly different question about that subject that has to do with Sixth Amendment obligations of counsel. In your view, did defense counsel for Mr. Brock have a duty at that detention hearing to ensure that any waiver made by Mrs. Brock would have been voluntary, knowing, and intelligent?
In my view, yes, Your Honor.
He remained silent, if I recall correctly, or there's nearly silent.
There's no indication in the record that Mr. Brock's attorney offered him advice on this matter. It could have happened off camera, but Mr. Brock says that it didn't. But I think, with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Rinka?
Please, the court, counsel, good morning. Matthew Rinka on behalf of the United States. Good morning. In this case, the government maintains that this court's precedent in United States versus Upton is undisturbed by more recent Supreme Court cases, particularly Begay versus United States and Sykes versus United States, indeed, because of the later clarification that was provided by the Supreme Court in Sykes. The question, in the government's view, really then in this case becomes, what is it about Begay? What is it about Sykes that compels a result different from that reached by this court in Upton? In the government's view, the answer to that question is nothing. The reason being that in Begay, the Supreme Court dealt with an issue, a case, and a statute that centered around a strict liability offense, drunk driving. In explaining its result in Begay, the Supreme Court used a phraseology that it admitted in Sykes was completely detached from the statute itself. The Supreme Court said that in order for the offense in question to be a violent felony, it must be purposeful, violent, and aggressive in order to be similar in kind to the enumerated offenses in the ACCA statute in 924E. By using that purposeful, violent, and aggressive language, which the Supreme Court later agreed and indicated was detached from the statutory language itself, was somewhat of a camel's nose of confusion, if you will, because prior to Begay, the vast majority of the courts of appeals that had looked at the issue that we're looking at today, which is really possession of a restricted weapon, an NFA weapon, the National Firearms Restricted Weapons, the courts of appeals were largely on the side of this is clearly a violent felony, this is clearly a crime of violence. And in its brief and its research, the government views these terms, violent felony, crime of violence, in this particular context as interchangeable. And indeed, this court has as well. This court has consistently applied the residual clause of ACCA, has consistently construed the residual clause of ACCA as being identical to the residual clause of the sentencing guidelines, and has indicated time and again that there's no reason to treat those two clauses differently.
Could you address the Sentencing Commission's application note to 4B1.4, which in essence is where the Commission tells us, look, we're just interpreting this term for purposes of the guidelines, not for purposes of the Armed Career Criminal Act?
Well, as far as the Commission's commentary on that particular issue, Your Honor, it's the government's position that clearly the Commission wouldn't insert itself into the debate that we're having here today, which is what is a violent felony
right.
under ACCA.
So if they wouldn't, why should we defer to their view when they define the term violent felony? Or crime of violence. I got them mixed up.
If the question is, why should we apply the two similarly?
No. The question has to do with the argument made by the defendant that if we interpret the two in lockstep, we are effectively deferring to the Sentencing Commission on the question of statutory interpretation.
I would disagree with that. The government would disagree with that. The government's position is simply this. I believe that when we look at these two definitions separately, there is a qualitative analysis that is undertaken in both cases. A qualitative analysis that determines, with respect to the residual clause alone, is what we're looking at a crime of violence under the sentencing guidelines or a violent felony under ACCA. The qualitative analysis would take place, and could take place, in fact, if we were here on the same issue with respect to possession of the machine gun, but under the sentencing guidelines. And the reason being that, and as this court has recently pointed out in Raup, the issue is whether or not what's in the application notes contradicts what's in the text of the guidelines and or any federal statute or the Constitution. So, in other words, in order for what is in the application notes, outlined in the application notes, to be in sync with what's in the text of the guidelines, those enumerated offenses in the application note must be and must meet the definition of a crime of violence under the residual clause.
Well, okay. That's an argument that says, in essence, we ought to defer to the Sentencing Commission, right?
No, Judge. I think what I'm saying is that the same qualitative analysis exists in both forums. Ultimately, however, you have two provisions that are identical. And so for purposes of ACCA, we must look and determine whether or not this is an offense that has the serious potential for physical injury, and we have the same exact provision under the sentencing guidelines. And the argument being made under the sentencing guidelines would be, well, possession of a machine gun isn't that. It doesn't present that same physical, serious potential risk of physical injury that burglary or arson or extortion do, and therefore it is in conflict with the text of the guideline itself.
Let me come at this a different way. Are you suggesting that if we agree with the defense on the interpretation of the Armed Career Criminal Act, that we should also say at the same time that the application note that says unlawful possession of a firearm in Section 5845A is an invalid advisory note because it conflicts with the terms of the guidelines?
I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that if the Sentencing Commission has determined, for purposes of the sentencing guidelines alone, that possession of a machine gun, possession of an NFA weapon, is a crime of violence because it meets that textual definition, the government's position is that is certainly persuasive that...
Not controlling.
Well, it's persuasive, but the issue then becomes the opinions of this court, which have later said that the two definitions are identical. And with respect to those two provisions, there is no reason to treat those texts differently. So, and I believe it was in Upton, the exact phraseology was, if this obtains under the sentencing guidelines and our analysis under the sentencing guidelines, it obtains under the ACCA as well because the definitions are identical. The government doesn't see any conflict with that, Your Honor, because we believe that the qualitative analysis must be undertaken with respect to both provisions. But at the end of the day, in undertaking that analysis, the possession of the machine gun meets that statutory definition.
How about does the possession of explosives meet that definition?
Yes.
Why? Particularly given this, you know, the statutory argument, the textual argument, that says use of explosives is a crime of violence, but doesn't say anything about possession.
The government's position is we have these enumerated offenses, and then we have a comma and this, or otherwise, presents this serious potential risk of bodily injury. Mm-hmm. And what that does is it tells us that here are enumerated offenses, but there are other offenses in this realm that could meet this definition of violent felony. And so with respect to this possession, and the court well knows, we're not dealing with something that's innocuous, like, you know, this isn't possession of unregulated possession of teapots or something that is not in and of itself inherently dangerous. But when we talk about possession of items that are in and of themselves inherently dangerous, weapons of war, mere possession, because of the nature of that item, mere possession is sufficient.
Would you agree that a person can be convicted of unlawful possession of a machine gun if the machine gun is locked in an attic, is not operable, and there's no ammunition within 50 miles of it that fits it. Still be convicted, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe so, and then okay, obviously there
so,
are...
So, if it's that easy to violate that statute under circumstances where the weapon actually poses no immediate threat, why should we treat that as a crime of violence?
Because, Your Honor, the at least with respect to the cases that have come down from the Supreme Court, it's the government's interpretation that we're supposed to look at the ordinary case before the court.
Do we have any information about the ordinary case of machine gun possession?
The government would submit that the ordinary case is a case more along the lines of, I can't cite statistics
based
for Your Honor.
What? No. I mean, we don't have any information like that.
Okay. Mr. Rinka, can I bring you back to the textual point that Judge Hamilton alluded to? And you're suggesting that it's the government's position that although Congress used the term use of an explosive, it also meant to include possession of an explosive within the definition of violent felony. But rather than simply saying use and or possession of an explosive, it wanted courts to use this roundabout way of the residual clause to include possession within that category. That doesn't seem very respectful of the choices, the drafting choices that Congress made in the statute.
I think with respect to the prior question, and my individual response was that yes, possession of explosives can fit within that otherwise clause, but I think, again, going back to the qualitative analysis that has to be undertaken, the questions would be asked what kind of explosives they were. And very similarly laid out in the same section, 5861 and 5845 of Title 26, there are destructive devices, which are explosives, which certainly, in the government's view, possession of things like pipe bombs and other sorts of bombs would be...
How about TNT? Mm-hmm. I mean, not a constructed bomb, but...
Mm-hmm. Unregulated TNT. Possession? Just
yeah.
TNT?
Mm-hmm.
It's possible, Judge.
Mm-hmm. Sorry
well,
to interrupt.
Well, if Congress wanted to make possession of an explosive a crime of violent or violent felony, why didn't it just say use or possession? And the fact that it didn't say use or possession, it simply said use, doesn't that provide perhaps the strongest indication that Congress did not intend mere possession to qualify as a violent felony?
Well, Your Honor, I think that in enacting the statute the way they did, Congress clearly didn't give us a laundry list of all the possibilities of what would fall under the residual clause of ACCA. And for that reason, it left the language such that we would have this discussion, this qualitative discussion about what is and what is not. What are the risks of possessing certain things over others? But it continues to be the government's position with respect to machine guns, sawed-off shotguns, destructive devices, in this case, obviously, machine guns being the key, that simply because they are what they are inherently dangerous. The unregulated possession of these kinds of weapons is clearly a violent felony.
Mr. Rinka, could I ask you a couple of questions about the spousal privilege issue here? What do you think the standard is for spousal waiver? And how could it be satisfied when nobody even brought the issue to Mrs. Brock's attention?
Judge, with respect to spousal waiver, it's the government's position that there was no need to advise her of the.
I know there's some case law to that effect, but if we need a knowing and voluntary waiver, how do we get that without somebody talking to this woman whose husband has just been arrested and put in jail about the issue.
The government's not convinced that a knowing and voluntary waiver is necessary in this context, Your Honor.
What do you think the standard is, and on what basis?
In this particular case, Your Honor, the government believes that the offering of testimony in a proceeding, an adversarial proceeding of this nature, and subjecting herself to cross-examination under oath was sufficient.
But your cross-examination went way beyond the scope of direct, right? Mm. Didn't draw an objection.
Correct.
You, in essence, got to do a free deposition and turn her into a prosecution witness, right?
Correct, Your Honor. But the government would also point out that in the context of this particular case, with this particular defendant's criminal history and the possibility that a magistrate court would let this defendant out without bond, actually, on his own recognizance, to live in the house of this particular of his wife, the government believed it was relevant to ask these questions, to elicit information, to alert the court that there was an issue here, because he would be living with her. She knew he was a felon. She knew he had access to firearms, and we believed that was a problem, and we believed it was extremely relevant for the issue of detention.
Mm-hmm. On the standing issue that you all have raised, is it your view that if she wanted, or if the defense wanted to preserve that issue, she would have had to have been convinced to refuse to comply with Judge McKinney's order, be held in contempt, and then take an emergency appeal in the middle of the trial? Is that the way we ought to handle those issues?
That's the government's understanding. There are cases out there that suggest that that's exactly what would have to happen.
Do you think that's the most sensible way to handle it? With a jury waiting?
I'm not sure that I sensible way. That it's a difficult question to answer. I mean, I think that that's the way that we would have proceeded, because that was the guidance that we had from the case law that we were seeing in the research.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Rinka. Mr. Hudson.
Thank you, Your Honor. 3 points on rebuttal. First, it's important to point out that the statutory language related to crime of violence just says crime of violence. The definition of crime of violence is left entirely to the Sentencing Commission. So it's not that the statutory language related to ACCA's residual clause, section 924E2B, is identical to the statutory language dealing with crime of violence, section 924H. All section 924H, it says crime of violence, and leaves it to the Sentencing Commission to define crime of violence. So if the Sentencing Commission wanted to include everything that's in the application notes in the text of the guideline, it could. And presumably courts would think that's okay, because Congress really left the crime of violence term wide open for the Sentencing Commission to deal with. And the fact that the Sentencing Commission has concluded that mere possession of a restricted weapon should count as a crime of violence really doesn't tell this court or any court anything about whether or not it should count as a violent felony, because when the Sentencing Commission is deciding what to count as a crime of violence, it's taking into account a host of factors that may or may not have anything to do with whether or not that crime is similar in terms of manner and degree of risk posed to the enumerated offenses in ACCA: burglary, arson, extortion, and use of explosives. Second, the government relies heavily on this court's prior precedent in Upton, and obviously stare decisis has great value, and we respect the court's prior decision. But even in the absence of Begay and Sykes, Upton's not consistent with ACCA's text. Upton didn't discuss burglary, arson, extortion, and use of explosives in deciding whether or not mere possession counted.
You don't have to go that far, do you?
No, I don't.
I guess all you have to argue is that there's been a lot of water under the bridge since Upton, and that the court ought to reevaluate its precedents in light of those decisions.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's my primary position.
Okay.
Finally, I think it's important to point out the government seems to paint Michael Brock as this guy that needed to keep in jail during his pre-trial detention phase. But Mr. Brock was arrested here for possessing a .38 caliber handgun, a .22 caliber rifle, and a 12-gauge shotgun, weapons which were found in many homes across the United States. He wasn't allowed to have them because he was a prior felon, but this was not a machine gun conviction. This case was not. The prior case involved machine guns. That was more than a decade ago.
More than machine guns, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. The prior conviction involved machine guns and some other offenses.
Explosives.
And dealing in explosives, yes. And also a conspiracy to deal in explosives and machine guns. But the only convictions which the district court counted as violent felonies in this case were the prior convictions for possessing a machine gun. It's worth noting, I think, that Mr. Brock's case really points out the error in treating possessory crimes as violent felonies. Between his prior convictions and this conviction, he will have spent nearly a quarter of a century, more than half of his adult life, in jail. And he's never done anything that would indicate, in the parlance of Breguet and Sykes, that he's the type of person who would point the gun and pull the trigger.
The only thing I saw was that he bit somebody trying to fingerprint him in the PSR. But that was the only indication I saw that he'd ever hurt anybody.
Yes, Your Honor. He's never been convicted of causing physical harm to anyone, which is really the main kind of focus of ACCA's residual clause. So we would ask this court to reverse the district court's holding that Mr. Brock's prior convictions for possessing machine guns count as violent felonies, and also to adopt a rule that a spouse cannot knowingly waive her spousal testimonial privileges at a pre-indictment detention hearing when unwarranted. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hudson. Thank you.